Wretched Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
So it's not a sin in your church to have an abortion?
That's the kind of conversation we would have finding out your story, where you're from. God's the judge. People have to live to their own conviction.
The science is clear. The Bible is clear. And if we're honest, our intuitions are clear. We know what we're killing. We're killing a human being.
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Oh, the shame. This is Wretched Radio. Oh, I could have had a V8. I want to hit myself in the head so hard. I shared with you recently on this here Wretched Radio broadcast some of the classic humor. Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. Karnak the Magnificent, who was playing spoofily. Spoofily, that's right. I just said spoofily. A soothsayer. Ed McMahon would hand him an envelope. He'd put it up to his forehead and divine what was inside of the envelope. And, of course, it would always be a joke. So the example I gave was Johnny Carson holding the envelope to his forehead saying, "Sis boom ba, sis boom ba," opening up the envelope. Johnny Carson then said, "Describe the sound a sheep makes when it explodes." Sis boom ba, sis boom ba. I said cat. Describe the sound a cat makes when it blows up. I totally biffed the joke and I'm ashamed of myself. Oh, I can't. So I've had to analyze. All right, why did I replace a sheep with a cat that was to be exploded? Maybe my love of dogs is too great and my lack of love for kitty cats was Freudianly surfacing through sis boom meow instead. But that wouldn't have been just as funny, would it? Sorry for the error. I'm ashamed. I'm simply ashamed. Now, here's a question. What should I do with that shame? More broadly, may I ask, what do we do with our bad feelings? What do we do with our, that I did that thing? I said that hurtful sentence. I did that thing which caused pain. How do you and I think when we feel bad? Let me expand this even more. What do we do when we feel bad, period? I'm depressed. I'm anxious. I'm worried, agitated, frustrated. I'm all of those things. How am I supposed to feel when I'm feeling really rotten? I would say, before sharing what I think the biblical principle is, there can be an exception to this rule. And the exception would be if it is your conscience that is nagging you, you've got to deal with it, not override it, but deal with it. If you've committed a sin in 2 Corinthians 7 style, you can make it right. Do it. If you haven't confessed your sin to God, do it. If you haven't been grateful for his forgiveness, do it. Having said that, the exception being a conscience issue that demands a response from us, I would like to suggest to you our feelings need to henceforth submit to truth. Was reading an article by Paul Todgers. He just does some very fine work. The headline was, "We are called to believe and obey God's word before our emotions agree." This is going to sound perhaps frighteningly like fake it till you make it, but it's not exactly that. That would be secular advice. Well, just start thinking right and you'll catch up eventually. No. This is a little bit more profound, more accurate, and more helpful. We recognize as Christians our brains are busted. They're kafritz. They don't reason right. They are not good at doing the function that they were designed to do because of the fall. We get that. Now, the question is, how do we fix that? We don't fake it till we make it. Instead, we consider what lies we are currently believing, because that's what our bad emotions are when they're inappropriate emotions. That's what they are. They're lies. We've got to correct it with truth. And so I need to learn how to think about the truth when I am feeling the blues and say, am I being told a lie here? Now, remember, there can be an exception to this, the conviction of your conscience. But if you're feeling, for instance, scared of the future, what's the lie underneath that? And the answer can be manifold, but one would be you're not trusting in your strong God. His right arm is mighty, and he has you in his sights at all times, more profoundly and deeply than you even know yourself. You have nothing to fear. Now, there might be some scary things. I'm not dismissing a real human emotion. But if it's turned you into a nail-biting worry wart, well, then you're just believing a lie. God isn't in control. You are. We got to figure out the lie so that we can instruct our brains to operate under the principle of truth. Let's see if Paul Todges can help us with this subject. We are more prone to say, this is how I feel, therefore this is what I will do, rather than this is what I think because the Bible says so. Isn't that a distinction that you and I tend to blur just a little bit? Feelings, it's very much a romantic philosophy. If you recall, the romantics, in response to the empiricists, thought that emotions and feelings were lacking, and so they focused on feelings. They focused on emotions. They focused on self. And we see it then in musical styles, literature, poetry, the romantics, Byron, Shelley, Keats. And the idea came into full blossom, I think, relatively recently, courtesy with a bit of a steroid injection called postmodernism, that we just, what do you feel? What's your truth? You be you. You do you, I do me, and we'll live together in harmony. Was that a Michael Jackson, Paul McCartney song? Maybe I'm confusing
it
something.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, whatever. That's why we have the platitudes and the bumper sticker philosophy that we see so often these days. Trust yourself. Oh, no, bad idea. Where does it come from? Romanticism. And I think it goes back even further. It goes back to the garden. We want to do what makes us happy. We want to feel the way that we want to feel. We need to replace that. And we need to submit to what God says we are to be feeling. And you don't bypass the intellect to get to the emotion center. You don't just expect God to bibbidi-bobbidi-boo you into feeling better today. Instead, we think on what is true. And eventually, your emotions are going to follow. Might take longer. If you're struggling with something like OCD, obsessive blasphemous thoughts, perhaps. It's in there pretty deep. It's sort of like deleting a file, but not putting it in the trash. You know, you make these marks in your brain. You form these memories with bad thinking. And unless you put that thought, not just in the delete bin, but in the trash to make it go away forever, although it does seem increasingly like nothing we do on the computer goes away forever, does it? That we have got to replace those deeper impressions, those scars, wounds, bad thinking with truth. And it can take a while. And we shouldn't put a deadline on when you need to be done with your OCD. Instead, we continue to encourage replace lies with truth. From the Valley of Vision, great prayer book. Lord, help me to honor thee by believing before I feel. For great is the sin if it makes a feeling a cause of faith. The Puritans got that. They understood truth must come before feelings. So our Puritan brothers and sisters had the same old feelings we do. And they addressed it rightly. From Paul Todges, the only proper ground of faith is the never-changing, always enduring Word of God. Consider the 11th chapter of Hebrews. Notice the relationship of God's Word to faith, that it is how biblical faith is a response to God's objective revelation rather than the result of something we feel. So just one example, by faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age because she judged him faithful who had promised. It was ridiculous for humans. She believed it, did it. That's the pattern that we need to follow. Heroes of the faith believed before they felt. If Noah had waited for the flood to start building a boat, having never seen rain, he would have never driven the first peg. If Abraham had waited until he felt like leaving his parents to obey God's call, he would have died of old age in his father's house. And if Sarah had waited until she felt like believing that a 90-year-old woman could have a baby, she would still be laughing. What makes these people stand out is their act of obeying God's revelation, even if, perhaps especially if, the feelings do not agree. That is what we do with our wayward, depressed, sad feelings. This is Wretched Radio.
Hey, it's another day and another Wretched Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us for this edition of Wretched Radio. We certainly appreciate your time. Every month, Wretched sends out a newsletter. If you haven't already signed up for that, it covers tough theological issues and keeps you up to date on all things new at Wretched. You'll receive updates on not only what's happening at Wretched, but you'll also receive thorough and in-depth messages on a wide range of theological issues that Christians face today. Sign up for the Wretched newsletter if you haven't done so already. You do that at wretched.org/newsletter. That's wretched.org/newsletter. And while you're on our website, take a look at becoming a gospel partner. It's gospel partners that make everything we do at Wretched possible. We would love for you to pray about and consider becoming a monthly partner with Wretched. Your faithful and consistent support will help Wretched reach millions of people all around the world. Wretched, amazing grace, amazing gospel.
This shopping rule has been officially broken. You know the rule. You're in the store. You're choosing between two items. One is more expensive. It's the nicer one, you think. And it's better than the less expensive item. You can't have both. It can't be inexpensive and good. That rule has just been broken. MediShare. Double the satisfaction rate of people who have traditional health insurance. MediShare is affordable biblical health sharing, and it saves the average family $500 per month. And yet, the people, the 400,000 people that are in the MediShare program, are more satisfied with MediShare than other folks with traditional health insurance. The rule has been broken. Learn how much you could save and be happy with MediShare at 844-34-BIBLE, 844-34-BIBLE.
Okay, so which is cooler, identifying as a boomer, a millennial, or a Gen Zer? That was a trick question, because the coolest thing to identify as is a gospel partner. When you become a gospel partner, not only are you helping Wretched keep the lights on, but you're also helping us to spread the gospel to those who need it. If you love watching and listening to Wretched every day and want to help keep us on the air, would you please consider becoming a gospel partner? Every dollar you give is carefully and gratefully stewarded away. If you're already a gospel partner, we are eternally thankful for you. Your support means the world to us. Without you, there is no Wretched. So sincerely, thank you. To become a gospel partner, just visit wretched.org/donate or text Wretched to the number 44321. That's wretched.org/donate or text Wretched to the number 44321. Wretched, amazing grace, amazing gospel.
Important dates in Christian history. 1948, the World Council of Churches is formed as an interdenominational body promoting Christian unity and presence in society. Modern ecumenism saw differing denominations work together in spiritual and social causes, but also resulted in the watering down of Christian doctrine. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Nope, not 60 minutes. Instead, tick, 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 time is ticking for you, sir. This is Wretched Radio. What sands are dripping from the hourglass? The season that perhaps you are currently in. You are married and you have children. It is a most delightful season. And if you don't mind me interrupting myself, Friel, when don't you interrupt yourself? Hey, having the 80, whatever that thing is called, isn't always easy. Okay? Triggered. You are in a season that you should be delighting in, but there is a chance you are maybe languishing in. Oh, the kids are exhausting. Oh, they're just so demanding. Oh, I need to get up in the middle of the night. I can promise you that if you love your wife and kids, you will look back on that season and you will wonder, what do I need to do to go back? Not to do it again and make up for the wrongs that you did, because unless you were able to jump into some Michael J. Fox time machine and come back with the wisdom you possess as an older man or woman, you wouldn't do any better. So I'm not saying to look back and I spanked my child when I shouldn't have that one time. No, you're going to look back and you're going to go, oh, I miss those sweet times. And you won't really grasp that until it's gone, which is where Proverbs comes in. Trust those who have gone before you, those who love their wives and children. They look back and just remember those special times, those special years that are so fleeting. And I would say this, and this is going to sound pretty radical, but I suspect this might need to be a word heard by somebody out of the tens and tens of people listening to this here Wretched Radio program. Having a girl, oh, man, you've heard the old cliche. Daughters think their daddies hung the moon. You know why that cliche endures? Because they do. And they are so sweet. And they love their daddies. And daddies love their daughters. So if you maybe are like Tevye, and you have been given by God lots of daughters, just enjoy it, man. And don't lament that you don't have a boy. Look, it's okay to want a boy. It's okay to want a girl. I don't think it's okay to think that one is better than the other, because it's not. Not to argue against my own gender, but I got to tell you, having girls, I dug it. I dug it a lot. And the years of carrying them, picking them up, holding them, cuddling with them, all would be creepy because they're in their 20s now. Those times go. Enjoy them. Discursus is completed. Let's get to instead remembering our wives, because there is going to come a time, and it's going to happen lickety split, where the kids are gone. Do you recall Dr. John Street? I shared this after attending his marriage seminar. Dr. John Street was teaching about marriage and the stages of marriage. And he was talking about every decade. This is typically what you go through this decade. 20s, figuring it out, getting your feet on the ground, getting married, hopefully. What are kids waiting to now? Like, the average age, I think, for the kids getting married is what, 40? Whatever it is. It's just, you get married in your 20s and you're getting a lot of stuff figured out and you're establishing yourself, your direction in life. 30s, well, the kids are growing a little bit and you're starting to obtain some wisdom, but your home is probably really kid-centered. 40s, you're dealing with the teenage years, which brings in a whole different bag of luggage that is filled with challenges. That's what you're going to go through in the 40s. 50s, uh-oh, things change, and they change radically. And if you have forgotten your wife, and conversely, I would say, madam, if you have forgotten your husband because you've become so kid-obsessed, that's perhaps why so many people in their 60s get divorced. That's what Dr. John Street pointed out. Our homes become so kid-centered, even when we persuade ourselves, not our home. Oh, I know some people. Oh, they do everything for that kid. Oh, they... They never spank that kid. Whatever. It's, we do it. We're fine. Hold on. Your kid's centered because you got them and they demand it. And you shouldn't try to just cut them off. That isn't the point of this, but you need to be aware your relationship and dynamic with your spouse, because of it, is under assault. Yep, I'll use the military language. It is. And it's worth fighting for it with the correct weapons, not killing the kids, not ending our relationship with them or being involved in their lives. No, be involved deeply, profoundly in those precious years. That's your job. That's my job. But not at the neglect of my marriage with my spouse. We've gone through that. I think it happened about 4 or 5 years ago. The kids, gone, living on their own. Thankfully, really close. But nevertheless, outside of our home. And wow, did that, like, I've been groping to try to find and articulate a sentence even, or even a word that captures, it's just different. That's all I'm saying. It's just different. Same man, same woman, same home, probably, unless you did the downsize thing. And there you are. And there's nothing else going on. It's just her. And nobody told me about this. Nobody warned me that this is going to happen. Because there are dangers. Now, just to give a spoiler alert, I dig my wife. Where I really have to watch out for it being an idol. I really dig my wife. For instance, Friel, we didn't ask for a for instance. For instance, when I'm done with work and she's perhaps in her car or she's perhaps at home and I'm leaving the office, and I want to contact her because that's the first part. I want to talk to my wife. Despite the fact that she tells me, you know, it's always so glitchy. Could you just call me instead of FaceTiming? I had to ask myself the question, why do I persist not obeying her request? And it's super annoying. Hey, sweetheart, it's me. Listen, I'm just leaving right now. So I was thinking that I could stop at the grocery. I couldn't hear you. Hey, sweetheart. You're cutting up again. It's really annoying and I keep doing it. Why? Because I just want to see her. That's all I've concluded. I want to see my wife because I adore my wife. I love my wife. And so this empty nesting business, it did not capsize our boat. But waves hit that I just want. It's just different. See, I can't find the word of the sentence. It's just, Well, the whole rhythm of the home is off. I think that's what I'm trying to say. The rhythm of your home changes. And if you don't dig your spouse when those changes hit, you're going to be reading the billboards that offer discounts on divorces. And you are going to be thinking, how do I get out of this? And it happens way too often. And it doesn't need to. So how do we remember our wives, a.k.a. husbands, if you're a girl? This is from Nicholas Batzig from FTC for the church. It can happen so quickly. Men, be aware of this. We can go day after day chasing the adventures of our jobs and fail to look at our wives as an adventure. She may be okay with this for a day, a week, a few months, or possibly even years. But a wife who is not pursued as an adventure, who is not fought for, who is not wooed over, will eventually break down. Doesn't mean she's going to get a divorce from you, but she'll break down. And you can see that in some women, can't you? Maybe you saw them 10 years ago filled with joy, and now you met them yesterday and they were pretty blue. Now, granted, it could be something temporary. But I think you know what I'm talking about, where they just get sapped of joy because their husbands are putting other things before her, and we can't. Now, the work thing, is needs to be considered carefully, because every man should be working. Even if the government offers to pay you more than what you can be getting. I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? Men should be working, and we should be the providers, and we should be working to protect our families. But sometimes we can do too much work. Is there ever a time where you're having to do a lot of work because of a particular season? Yes, but it has to be a season. What Nicholas Batzig is after is the guy who just gets wrapped up in his labors and doesn't pursue his own wife. And I can promise you, sir, if that describes you, you are headed for a shipwreck. You are headed for bleak times, and your golden years are going to be really rusty. We will discuss how to avoid that next on Wretched.
Books of the Bible. Jude was the brother of the Lord Jesus Christ. He wrote an epistle to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. He contends for the faith with a passionate and vehement attack against false teachers. When you want to know God's concern for the truth, Jude has 25 intense verses just for you. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Bad decisions, bad outcomes. This is Wretched Radio. For example, here's a bad decision. Abandoning a country that has warlords ready to fill in the gaps without an appropriate plan for disengaging. Nothing wrong with the U.S. government saying bye-bye to Afghanistan. How we do it needs to be in consideration of people. When we fail to remember there are human beings involved in political decisions, we are demonstrating that we are motivated by agenda and not what is best for people. Case in point, Taliban committing. This is from MSN, by the way. Taliban commit house-to-house executions. And there are Christians there. And there are still, my understanding is, at least hundreds of Americans still there. Furthermore, there's a lot of Muslims who are just trying to live their lives who are going to feel the heaviness of the Taliban. Now, I'm not making a claim that we should be doing any sort of nation building, but historically, we've got to remember our past. We're there, and we've done things, and we've invested, and we've brought in billions of dollars of weaponry, which we decided to leave behind, and they're now riding around in our tanks in their streets. When a government is just determined to go about the business of executing its agenda, it forgets about the human beings involved. And we were there. I'm not saying that we should go to every country where there is a bad leader, but we were there as with a commitment to helping them with all of our stuff and with all of our money and with all of our NGOs. And so to just pull the plug and vamoose without an appropriate plan, people are paying the price. That is one demonstration of a bad decision. Here is a much more personal one. Your decision to not pursue your wife all your livelong days. Nicholas Batzig, writing an article titled "Don't Forget Your Wife," reminding men it is all too easy for us to become preoccupied in stuff, work, business, raising kids, hobbies, buddies, watching TV, and we don't pursue our wives. And the decision to not make a conscious effort for that will result in horrific consequences. I'm telling you, it's going to be an issue in your home. One way or another, please permit me to repeat, the one way that we responded was, well, we enjoy our kids. We love seeing our kids, but we love living together as husband and wife. We love it. So we're cool because God has been kind to us. If That does not describe your attitude toward your spouse today as you're going about the business of rearing your children. You got to go to work. You just have to go to work. I get it. It's tiring. I understand. Believe me, we've raised three kids. Get it. I understand. And a dog. We understand the demands. But if you're not making an effort to continue to woo your wife, she is going to become a noticeably unhappy person. She may not divorce you, but you are going to be living with somebody who is just bankrupt emotionally. Let's let Nicholas Batzig help us with ways that he has learned to make sure that his wife does not feel forgotten. Are you ready to do a little inventory analysis? From Nicholas Batzig, he wrote, "She chooses our decorations, the color of our walls, the movies we watch, the food we eat, and the towels we use. Because I make it an active practice to say, whatever you would like, honey, whatever." I have to tell you, this is something that God graciously taught me. Because we would get, now that the kids are adults, and you all get together, and you ask the big question, where are we going to eat? Do you know where the best place is for us to eat?
I don't care.
Well, that should be the attitude. That wasn't my attitude. It was, no, my place, which was usually Zaxby's, which is the right place, honestly. But for some reason, the Lord just helped me to understand a simple sentence. It's just a meal. It's just wallpaper. It's just paint color. Now, does that mean you can't talk through it, share your preference? I'm not saying that you just become sort of mindless and doormatty. No. But do those things matter? Why not let her make decisions on something? You lose little battles. They're just little battles that are so insignificant. I'll bet there are hundreds of things that have gotten up your nose over the decades that you can't even remember today because they were that little. He writes, "I share my thoughts. However, at the end of the conversation, I let her choose because remember, it's only a meal." From Batzig, "I let her know that I will lay down my desires for hers when I do this. And therefore, she feels heard, seen, and loved." How simple is that? What do you want to do tonight, dear? This goes on in our home constantly. And this is the ideal, by the way, when both spouses are doing this. It's if you do it, don't worry about your spouse doing it. You do it. But if you've got both spouses going, no, what do you want to do tonight? That means before you know it, it's going to be bedtime because you'll have spent 3 hours going, no, what do you want to do? No, I don't care. What do you want to do? And that's a way to fill up an evening. I'm not saying it's a good way to fill it up, but it is a way to fill up an evening. And you are saying to the other, I value you more than myself. Your needs come before my needs. It's a little way to communicate. I dig you. That wasn't the way Nicholas Batzig phrased it. He writes, and these are some practical things. Make dates priority. A husband who stops dating his wife is a husband whose wife will soon feel forgotten. Have you done that? I've heard this before. There's something about it that rankled me when I heard the lecture about, all right, you've got kids. Don't forget about one night a week. It's got to be couch time. Maybe I didn't like it because it just felt kind of like a law. It should be a desire. That's, I think, the way that this is not just palatable, but good. Because there is goodness that comes out of it. Going out together. I know the kids are a challenge. You got to find somebody to take care of them. It's okay. And then go out. And even if it's just the kids are in bed because it's a season, then go out on a date underneath your own roof. She will feel pursued and valued. Because let me tell you, when those kids no longer demand your attention, it's you and her. Communicate about seasons. Batzig writes, I communicate with my wife about the week ahead, the month ahead, and even the season ahead. What does this do for a wife or for a husband? Let them know what's on the horizon. Not going to take it by surprise. And I'm thinking about you. And I want to share this with you so you know what I'm up to and why I'm making some decisions that I'm making. That's not hard to do, is it? Communicate about the week ahead, the month ahead, and even the season ahead. That's helpful. You like that, don't you? Do you like getting blindsided at work? What? No, you like to know what's coming up. It's a whole lot more palatable when you know, for instance, during the month of September, we are going to have a ton of outside shoots. Now, we could have waited until the day before to let the crew know, this crew's going here, that crew is going there, and the third crew is going to another place. But we didn't. We let them know in advance so that they could prepare for it. They appreciate it, and so will your wife. Final practical tip for pursuing your wife and avoiding a 60-year-old shipwreck, turn the world off. Intentionally leave your phone in another room. Turn it off or give it to her. Show her you're actually more captivating than this device is. You've done it. You've seen people at restaurants texting with one another, and you have rightly judged. Hey, hello, another human being. You got your kids there. How's about, I don't know, finding joy and interest in them? Maybe you need to do that yourself at home. You know that little report you get at the end of the week that tells you how many hours you've been on your cell phone each day? Take a look. What is it? I don't know what the average is anymore. I can't remember. I think for the kids, it's about 80 hours a day, something like that. And for the rest of us, it can be hours, hours. As Joe Biden would whisper, put it down, put down your phone. Find your joy, your delight in your wife. And that means you're going to have to work. And that means you're going to be pursuing her. And that means when the kids finally skedaddle from the home, you are going to have each other and you two will dig it, man. This is Wretched Radio. Be careful. Be very, very careful, my cold-hearted conservative friend, because this just might melt your heart if you are a supporter of preborn.org/wretched, providing ultrasounds, ultrasound machines, and sonograms. Careful, this might just melt your heart.
That sonogram changed my life. I went from just Candace to mom. Thank you to everybody that has given these gifts. You guys are giving more than money. You guys are giving love.
You're giving love when you support Preborn, because a mommy sees a baby in the womb courtesy of an ultrasound machine and 80% of the time keeps the baby. $28 an ultrasound, or perhaps you might be of the means to provide an actual ultrasound machine if you can. Oh, they need them, and they'll put them to work, and it'll show some love. Preborn.org/wretched.
What is a worldview? Simply put, it's how people view the world. Not physically, though, but rather a comprehensive viewpoint on everything that exists and matters. And these days, most evangelicals have adopted a dualistic worldview, which means that they place Christianity in the realm of faith, while logic, reason, science, and even morality are fixed in the realm of reality. And the results have been pretty evident. Christians who are operating without a proper Christian worldview. And our newest resource, Wretched Worldview, seeks to change all that. Todd Friel and Dr. Owen Strand gather to tackle 22 tough contemporary issues through a biblical lens that puts our Christian worldview into clear focus. Not to tell you what to think, but how to think these issues through. Wretched Worldview also comes with a study guide, which is perfect for any Bible study or Sunday school class. Order your copy today at wretched.org/worldview. That's wretched.org/worldview.
The Eastern Orthodox Church retains control of 80% of the population in Eastern Europe. And according to Paul Marty of Tomorrow Clubs, that ain't a good thing.
People are terrified that if they somehow cross the Orthodox priest, that he's not going to bless them. And their blessing is so important in their culture. They won't do funerals. They won't do weddings. They won't, right. They won't bless the home if they aren't behaving. They really exert a lot of control over the lives of the people.
Tomorrow Club's changing that statistic, opening up hundreds of weekly kids' meetings. They're called Tomorrow Clubs. The kids get loved on. They hear the gospel. And they learn they don't have to fear pastor and God. It's a magnificent ministry. Would you please consider supporting your own Tomorrow Club? Just $30 a month for 30 little disciples. TomorrowClubs.org/wretched.
Lexicon. There are many words to help us understand the nature of the Bible. Words like sufficiency. The Bible tells us everything we need to know about God, salvation, doctrine, and life. We do not need any additional revelation to know who God is and what He requires of us. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Prepare for a very practical Bible study. This is Wretched Radio. You are a pro-life Christian, which is redundant. You believe that God is the one who knits babies together in their mother's womb. There is life at conception, not when there's a heartbeat, even though we're glad in Texas that it's more babies will live because of the heartbeat legislation that was just upheld. Nevertheless, while I'm grateful for the legislation, I don't like it. Because it says that it's a heartbeat that makes a human at 6 weeks. It's not. What makes a human is that they're human. They're God's image bearer. That's what makes them human. Not their functionality. Not their ability to contribute. Those are secular reasons for granting life, not Christian reasons. We believe that a baby is an image bearer of God and should be protected at conception. And that is why you and I can be grateful for the legislation that passes, but never satisfied. We want it gone, obliterated, dare I say, abolished. And as we go about that business, we need to change hearts and minds, and we need to respond to accusations like the one that people use in Exodus chapter 21 and verse 22. Here's what the verse says. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. That's your lex talionis, the law of retaliation, that it shouldn't be more than what was initially done. It needs to be proportional, proportionate. I think that's right. Proportionally proportionate, I think is correct. If a pregnant woman is punched and her child dies, but she herself lives, then the men who punched her are let off with a fine. This indicates that the death of the child is treated like the death of an animal, says the pro-choicer, which is an argument for not criminalizing abortion. Well, is that what the text is all about? This is from the Cripplegate, helping us to understand this verse. So when it gets thrown in your face, you can know what the verse is really saying. And what it's saying with that interpretation is you're making an assumption, namely that the baby in question did in fact die. Read the verse. If the baby comes out, doesn't mean that the baby's dead. It could have just been a trauma that caused the birth of the child. So let's start there, shall we? The Hebrew word used for children here is normally used to depict living children. And we see that cross-reference in Genesis 44:20, Isaiah 9:6. So if the child comes out is the word for a living child. By the way, the Hebrew word for that is which... very similar to, well, every other Hebrew word. Sorry. That just got a little bit wet. The word used for comes out in Hebrew is not the word for miscarriage, which is a word that is used in Genesis 31:38, Exodus 23:26, Hosea 9:4, 2 Kings 2:19. If you've ever wondered, why does your pastor do that? Why do articles do that? They say what the Bible says, and then they give all of the addresses. It's to show that the Bible does, in fact, say what I'm saying that it says. And it shows you when it's a lot of Bible verse, because it's like, well, I get one. You just need one. Well, it's emphatic if it's been used regularly. So the word used for comes out in Hebrew is not the word used for miscarriage. Instead, Moses uses a word that usually refers to a live birth. The same word used in, here we go, Genesis 25, 25 through 26, 38, 27 through 30, and Jeremiah 1, 5. Oh, so I guess it was important to not nod off during Hebrew class. Actually, not a bad way to spend class time in Hebrew. But in this instance, just understanding the what the word means in the original language sure does make a difference, doesn't it? Am I suggesting you suddenly become a Hebrew scholar? Well, I wouldn't say you shouldn't, but I just think it's more helpful to become a little bit of a Greek student, not a professor, not somebody who is fluid in Koine Greek, but to understand how biblical Greek works is well worth your time. I recently heard about, what was the name? There was a resource that it's an amazing presentation on the basics of Greek. Oh, yeah, it's in our store, wretched.org. It's not Greek to me. It's not going to demand that you memorize what word means miscarriage or born or child, which all three, by the way. Instead, it's going to teach you how the language works, the importance of understanding tenses and declensions and cases. You're going to learn those basics so that when your preacher unloads a little bit of Greek knowledge on you, you go, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I get that. I know what that means. Back to our defense of life. The text does not demonstrate a lack of legal standing for the child who died. And they would say, therefore, it's not a human. However, there are four reasons why. From Cripplegate, first, the word used for the word child. By using this word, a live child, Moses makes clear that what came from the mother was not simply matter and blood. It was a human, not insignificant, but is spoken of in human terms. So you can't just say, therefore, it doesn't matter at all. Well, clearly it does, because Moses identified it as an actual person. Second, the context cares about intent. In this passage, it's pretty obvious the presumed death of the baby was not intentional. There was a fight. The pregnant woman was swept up in it and the baby died. They didn't mean to harm her. It just happened. Now, if you believe that it was a miscarriage, you have to ask, well, why did it happen? And the answer is there was a fight that was going on. It wasn't somebody trying to force a miscarriage. They were being dopes. And somebody got hit. This is not a capital crime. Even if we swap out the baby in this passage and replace her with an adult passerby, in that case, the one who struck the man and killed him could flee to a city of refuge. That, by the way, is why American laws have category distinctions. You've got murder one, lying in wait. Murder two, a crime of opportunity. Manslaughter, accidental, but the criminal was being reckless. The death of the baby in Exodus 21 would fit the latter, not the former. Hold on. There are more reasons that the text doesn't say babies don't have rights. Three, abortion is nothing at all like Exodus 21. Abortion is different in pretty much every aspect. It is not a case of two men fighting. It is not a case of accidental death. Two people being foolish against the wishes of the accidental death took place. It wasn't with permission of the parents. Abortion is, in some way, shape, or form. Abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent child. It is not done by the parents. It is done by somebody that they ask to do it. That's different than getting swept up in a fight, isn't it? And finally, the reason that this text doesn't dismiss child rights. There's no laws for killing an unborn calf either. Now, why did I add that to this list from Cripplegate? Well, they say that a human is no different than a cow. Okay, so let's just say that this happens to a cow. Two farmers are fighting. The cow gets tipped. Must have been napping. Quiet fight. They were jujitsu fighters. They were like grasshopper. Walking on the rice paper, very quiet, they tip the cow. The cow delivers a child, or let's even say miscarriages. The Bible doesn't give us say anything about calves either. My point is that if children and cows were the same, then the Bible isn't addressing either of those. And it should. But it doesn't. Will you be confronted with this? Yeah, probably. And by the way, we got to sharpen up our pro-life arguments. We do have a resource for that. Life is Best. It is outstanding. It also has a study guide. It could be perfect for the month of January in your church. I think it's like 11 or 12, 13 lessons, something like that. You can pick as many or few as you want, but it'll help you sharpen your arguments because what we're seeing, even with videotape of Planned Parenthood employees saying, yeah, we sell baby body parts. The guy who taped it is the one who is on trial, not the people who said it. And so we need better than video evidence. We need strong pro-life arguments. I would encourage you to avail yourself of Life is Best. Okay, maybe the clothes are a little out of fashion, but the contents most certainly is not. It will help you to become a pro-life apologist. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.